Welcome to The Explanation from the BBC World Service. I'm Johnny Diamond and this is The Conflict. Over the next half hour, we're going to look back at how a specific event from the past in the Middle East has shaped this moment and maybe, just maybe, try to understand what might happen next. Past, present and future. I've worked all across the Middle East for the BBC and I'm chatting with a carefully curated panel of journalists, experts and historians about the conflict in the region. In its relentless hunt for Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, you hear the half-century-old echoes of Israel's cheerily named Operation Wrath of God, its response to the atrocity at the 1972 Munich Olympics. That was launched after a Palestinian militant group kidnapped and killed 11 Israeli athletes at the Games. Israel's then Prime Minister, Golda Meir, instructed the Mossad, Israel's external intelligence agency, to find and to kill those responsible. Munich and Israel's long and vengeful response marked the start of the era of hijackings and kidnappings, gun and bomb attacks across Europe, the Middle East, North Africa and farther afield as Palestinian militants, supported by a variety of often revolutionary movements and Arab nations, did battle with Israel to draw attention to their cause. And Israel responded in bloody kind to deter and to take revenge. More than five decades later, that fight continues. Before we take a rootle around the past, Jeremy Bowen, the BBC's international editor, can bring us the background.
Well, I think to start with, it's still a very, very vivid moment, and it's vivid because Israel released that quite extraordinary drone video of his final moments before they killed him. But I think the way that that video has been perceived, I mean, I think that's actually all important, particularly on the Palestinian side, in the way that they look, not just at his death, but at his legacy.
Because in the video, contrary to what had become perhaps popular belief, Yahya Sinwar was not, you know, down a tunnel, broken and humiliated. He was, to the eyes of many Palestinians, right to the last, fighting back. We saw him fling something at the drone that had spotted him. It was a turnaround in people's perceptions.
Yeah, and in fact, because, of course, the Israelis don't let journalists into Gaza except for very specific, highly supervised, very rare, for certainly for us, trips into Gaza. So basically, we're not allowed in. You know, we have to rely on freelancers who we trust to do interviews and things like that for us. So we did. We got one of those guys to do some interviews. And one really struck me. It was a man who said, look, me and my friends, we really got that guy wrong. The point is, he was fighting. And for the Palestinians, that's, you know, symbolically very important.
But presumably none of that taints the victory for Israel.
No, they are absolutely cock-a-hoop about the fact that they've got this guy. I did hear some commentary suggesting that maybe this was going to change everything. I think it makes it much harder for Hamas because they've lost their very dominant leader. But will it change everything? No, I doubt it very much. There's a long history of Israel assassinating leaders of Hamas. Put all together, you know, it's another example from the Israeli perspective of pushing harder, attacking and killing their enemies.
Jeremy, thank you. Stay with us whilst we have a rootle around the past and try and shed some light on the present. I want to say first hello to Dr. Ronen Bergman, staff writer at the New York Times, based in Tel Aviv, who's just released a book, Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. Hi, Ronen. It sounds like we've got the right man for this discussion. Hi. Anyway, hello.
Hi, thank you for the invite.
Dr. Aviva Gutman, lecturer in strategy and intelligence at the University of Aberystwyth. Aviva, hello.
Hello.
And we're joined in the studio, thank you so much for coming in, by Nomi Bar-Yakov, an associate fellow at Chatham House, who has travelled the world negotiating and mediating international conflicts. Nomi, thank you very much for coming in. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you very much, Johnny, for having me here.
Ronen, I want to start with you to try and set the scene for us, if you could. It's the Munich Games. It's the first time the Olympics have come back to Germany since the Second World War. It's a huge event for them. And then I think it's on day 10, everything goes catastrophically wrong, September the 5th.
We know now that Black September, the operatives were planning for a long time how to attract the world attention in the most popular event, the Olympics.
It's not yet clear how the guerrillas, who are said to belong to an organization called Black September, got into the heavily guarded Olympic village. But at about 4 o'clock this morning, three men with blackened faces were seen to force their way into the block which houses the Israeli team.
They underestimate and underplay the threats. We know now that they had alerts. Some initial information came in, but they did nothing. And it was very easy for a group of close to a dozen Palestinian terrorists that were trained in Africa before to jump across the fence and go to the accommodation where the Israeli delegation was sleeping. And then started a horrible chain of events.
Soon afterwards, one shot was heard, but police have confirmed that two people were killed. The guerrillas sent out a message saying they would kill the hostages unless the prisoners were released and unless they themselves were allowed to leave Munich in safety.
And in the end, the Germans did not allow Israel to run a rescue operation. Instead, they tried, and it was poorly done. And at the end led to the death of some of the German policemen, but the death of all the remaining nine Israeli athletes there.
The terrorists and their hostages flew into Fürstenfeldbruck Airport shortly after 10:30 last night. For 30 minutes, they circled the airport, then they landed close to a Lufthansa jet which was standing by. And waiting in the darkness were army marksmen from Wiesbaden who'd been taken to the airfield earlier in a coach. Two of the guerrillas climbed from the first helicopter and walked over to inspect the jet. And as they walked back, the firing started.
And the world, the whole world, in shock and awe, looking in real time how Jews again on German territory are being slaughtered.
The impact of Munich was strong. It shook many people that they... manner in which our athletes were killed in Munich, in Germany, brought back memories of the Holocaust, of World War and pre-World War II misdeeds by Nazis. All this together with the feeling that Israelis are at the mercy of terrorists, but all over the world.
We're talking about the group that was known as Black September. Why, first of all, was the group so interested in using this event for its cause? What did it want to achieve? And also, where did Black September spring from?
Black September, the name comes from September 1970, when there was a Jordanian civil war and the Palestinians were evicted from Jordan. And that was a black month for the Palestinians. In any case, they were very frustrated with the situation in general. And so a splinter group of the mainstream Palestinian politics, the Fatah, out of Fatah grew this rather young Palestinian armed group. And they saw the Olympics as the world was watching the Olympics, and they wanted to use that platform to raise attention for their own cause.
Even after the Israeli team was taken hostage, before they were killed, there was plenty of time to negotiate their release. But I think the Germans made every mistake possible, and every step on the way, if you look at Mossad archives, which have now been lifted, it's very, very clear that they could have been saved and they were not.
What kind of response did Israel offer to the disaster of the Munich Olympics, Ronan?
To explain that, we need to explain what the Israeli government did not do until that time. Since 1968, from that point on, many in Mossad and other Israeli intelligence agencies urged their commanders, and their commanders, the Israeli prime ministers, especially Golda Meir, since she was appointed in 1969, to take a more aggressive approach towards the activity of the Palestinian organization inside Europe or outside the Middle East. They said to Prime Minister Meir, look, Ms. Prime Minister, we know from which offices, from which branches in Europe they are operating. We bring the information, they claim, to our counterparts in Europe. We alert them, but they, trying to maintain some kind of impartiality, do not do anything. They don't use the alerts that we give them. Give us the permission to act aggressively on European soil, and we'll teach them a lesson. They will have a significant price tag to anything they do to us overseas, and they understand and they will stop. And Prime Minister Meir refused. She said, no, I will not give you this permission. Stand down. If we ask them permission to kill someone on their territory, they will, of course, decline. And if we do not, they will be ballistic. This is what Munich changed. After Munich, Prime Minister Meir gave Mossad the permission to go to kill Palestinian operatives in Europe.
Do you think, Prime Minister, if negotiations ever were to take place to try and end this Middle East situation, that the Palestinians should have a seat at any conference table?
No. We will sit at any conference table with the Arab governments.
Not with the Palestinians?
No, because we have no negotiations with the Palestinians.
Aviva, can you pick this up? Because the permission is given, but it enters this sort of area spanning, what, Europe, North Africa, where Mossad pursues targets more loosely and more closely affiliated with what happened at Munich.
So they are starting to build up their bases in Europe. They decided that Paris should be their headquarters from where to plan the assassinations. And I would say the whole operation was kind of having like three main purposes. One clearly was vengeance, to avenge the death of the hostages that were killed at Munich. And so they wanted to kill every person who may have been involved in the organization of the Munich massacre. The second one was deterrence. They wanted to deter Palestinians in Europe and wherever they were in joining terrorist operations. Mm-hmm. So therefore instilling a sense of fear for their lives wherever they were, because that's also how they have chosen to kill them, right? They killed them sometimes in their own bedroom. Sometimes they killed them in the middle of the street when they were walking home. And the third one was prevention. So when they knew that a Palestinian was planning future attacks, then that was also a reason for them to be put on the kill list.
Nomi, Ronen talked about targeted assassinations, about the use of them. But Israel had used targeted assassinations in the past. It had, as a state, acted on that.
Well, I mean, they hunted down the Nazi criminals. Yeah. So after the Holocaust, and I think that was very important for them to do at the time. So, I mean, the practice didn't start in 1972. It started after World War II.
Can we talk about success and failure with the operation? Because there were some very noticeable successes, some very high-profile killings. There were also failures along the line, and there was the killing of people who were entirely unconnected with the militant Palestinian cause.
Part of the intent at the beginning was to kill, indeed, to kill the people who were behind it. But shortly after, Mossad realized that it's either that these people are far away or they are not very sure who was exactly behind that. And so they started to target operatives of the PLO wherever they could find them, with most of them having a very slim connection, if at all, to Munich. Most of the operations were done according to plan. Golda Meir, when it happened in Europe, called the chief of operation of Mossad and said, you make sure that it's only the target and not a hair falls from any civilian And Mossad tried to be very strict with that. The series of assassination ended with severe fiasco in Lillehammer.
They've been brought to trial in a windowless lecture hall close to the central police headquarters. The public prosecutor, Mr. Hakon Vika, called for sentences ranging between 6 and 9 years for complicity in the killing.
They not just killed the wrong person, they misidentified who was Ali Hassan Salameh, the operational mind behind Munich, which is also doubtful, but they were also caught and led to a downfall of much of the Mossad network, the Senat in Europe.
This is also a turning point in the way that the world deals with these kinds of acts of violence and the groups that carried them out, groups which proliferated in the years to come. It was a very different international situation after Munich, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a watershed moment for Israel's war against terrorism. And Israel took a very distinctive line of whoever comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first. In actual terms, kill what they saw as imminent danger. And I think Munich was also about retribution. Sinwar was also about retribution. But most of the many thousands of targeted assassination or attempted targeted assassination throughout the decades were looking at the future, trying to stop clear and imminent danger to the lives of Jews and Israelis.
We like to say on the programme that we stir up the past so that we can see the present. Looking at the past 5 decades, since Munich, since the Israeli response, are there things that you see repeating themselves or sounding a little alike?
Oh, we're skipping an awfully long time in the middle. I think there were issues like the assassination, for example, of Fathi Shikaki, the founder of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Malta in 95, which is extremely significant because he was an incredibly clever man from Gaza, and numerous others. So I think we need to deconstruct a little bit.
But Ronen suggests, and I think you agree with it, that Munich was where that line was crossed, that precedent was established, that with regards to its Palestinian enemies, Israel would reach out into third-party countries. And so we saw that continue.
Absolutely. No, Ronen described it as a watershed moment, and I would fully agree with that terminology.
Yeah.
That was a watershed moment leading to a policy where Israel is warning that all those who either threaten to attack it or attack it are going to be caught. And you can hear the current prime minister stating it.
Aviva, what kind of echoes and reflections do you hear and see down the decades from Munich towards where we are today?
We see that targeted assassinations have been and remain one of the cornerstones of Israeli security policy, and that for the for several decades already. And not only like security policy, but to a certain degree even foreign policy, when you think about that Iranian nuclear scientists had been assassinated. So it's not only about counterterrorism; it ventures into its policy, its foreign policy goals. But then again, we should also think about the long term. And think over the long term, all these assassinations, they did not make a difference, if you want to talk about, on the political level.
It was a significant tactical intelligence and operational success for Israeli intelligence and special operation units. And in times, a sophisticated, constant and clever use by Israel of targeted assassination led the other side to stand down. It forced the Hamas in 2004 to almost beg for a ceasefire after losing its leaders and its operatives and not being able to execute more suicide killings.
As we talk about Hamas, worth remembering it is, seen as a terrorist organization by the US, the EU, and the UK.
These successes led Israeli leaders, political leaders, to the wrong conclusion. They had the feeling as if at the tip of their hands, they had the ability to launch daring operation way beyond enemy lines and change history, that they hold history by its tail with their intelligence agencies and special operation commandos, and they don't need to have the closing leg of any war or any conflict, which is a political discourse, to speak with the other side, to reach a political settlement, and they can just resort to force. And so while the tactical achievements were very significant and the cradle for many TV series and cinema and books, it led to a significant strategic error and sometimes a catastrophe.
That is absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much to the three experts who've joined us to mull this.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for having me in the studio.
Jeremy Bowen, still with us, for which many thanks. Can you have our final word? I wonder what you think the history of what has been discussed here today, if anything, can teach us, can tell us about the future.
Look, I think this whole conflict is built on history. You measure this conflict in generations, generations who get caught up in it and generations of leaders. And there are some underlying principles, though. And from the Israeli point of view, it has, particularly since those events of the 1970s, it has become an absolute article of faith that they have a long arm and they will get you if you kill them, if you hurt them. They will take their revenge. They've been very open about this. But I was reading of late a memoir of a well-known journalist, Vincent Sheehan, who was here in the 1920s. And actually, if you change a few of the names, different kinds of cars and things like that in the descriptions, it really reminded me of Jerusalem. You know, I have been here on so many days over the years of awful conflict and trouble. And so the history is always there. So, yeah, I think that if you want to understand this conflict and you ignore the history, well, you'll make a big mistake because you'll never understand it. The only way of trying to work out where we are and where we're going to is to look back at where we've come from.
And that's exactly what The Conflict sets out to achieve. Our thanks to Jeremy Bowen, the BBC's international editor, helping us to take a look back on the events of 1972 and what they may tell us about the Middle East's future. In part two, we'll delve into June 1981 and explore what an audacious raid by Israel on a nuclear plant in Iraq can tell us about its relationship with the US. Hello, this is The Explanation from the BBC World Service. I'm Johnny Diamond with The Conflict. Over the next half an hour, we're going to look back at how a specific event from the past in the Middle East has shaped this moment and maybe, just maybe, start to understand what might happen next, past, present and future. I've worked all across the Middle East for the BBC, and I'm chatting with a carefully curated panel of journalists, experts and historians about the conflict in the region. When Donald Trump swept from being ex-president to president-elect, the Israeli Prime Minister was one of the first world leaders to congratulate him, calling it history's greatest comeback. In Donald Trump, Benjamin Netanyahu thinks he has one of his strongest possible supporters. Israel and the US are popularly portrayed as walking in lockstep, but the two countries have had a complex, at times rather rocky relationship, those diverging interests no more evident than on the 7th of June, 1981.
The Israelis said today that their jets attacked and completely destroyed Iraq's nuclear reactor on Sunday.
Iraq has called for an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council, and an urgent meeting of the Arab League is to be held. The League Secretary-General has described the attack as an act of terrorism.
The Americans say they were not consulted in advance, and they've joined the condemnation of the raid.
The Israelis pulled off an audacious raid on a French-built nuclear plant near Baghdad. Their concern that the reactor, once up and running, could provide fuel for nuclear weapons that might be used against Israel. Once the Israeli warplanes were over their Iraqi targets, Operation Opera took just 90 seconds to complete, a tactical triumph for the then Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, but for the US, a crisis, forcing it to condemn the actions of its ally and block some further arms sales. Operation Opera shines a light on Israel's approach to potential threats and is a reminder that the relationship between Israel and its greatest sponsor is one that waxes and wanes. In this part, we'll look to those times to try and understand these times. This is The Conflict. Let's first get some background to all of this.
Donald Trump has won the US presidential election.
It's now clear that we've achieved the most incredible political thing. Look what happened. Is this crazy?
This is on the occasion of Donald Trump's presidency. God bless America. God bless Israel. Woo!
The Middle East is also on the edge of drawing America into another major war.
I will stop the chaos in the Middle East, and I will prevent World War III, most importantly, from happening.
Tom Bateman is the BBC's US State Department correspondent. He hot-footed it to Washington after years as a Middle East correspondent. And he gave us this assessment of what Donald Trump's election in the US might mean for Israel and whether or not Israel might get a freer hand in the region as a result.
Well, the answer to the last part is yes, I think it will. And that's based both on what Donald Trump had said during the campaign, but also on his track record from his first term in office. And I think if you look at the kinds of things he was saying during the campaign, it is clear that what he wants to do is end the war, or end the wars as they are now, between Israel and Hamas in Gaza and Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. But a bit like what he said about Ukraine, if you know, this is stuff that is quite big on the promise, or big on the boast, you might say, but pretty small on the detail. You know, in terms of his first presidency, it is abundantly clear, both because of his very strong Christian evangelical voter base in the United States and because of the way he tended to deal with the Israelis and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu then, that we would expect a very clearly defined pro-Israel approach from him and his administration. So we have some sort of contours and the rough outline of what he probably intends to do, but the point is we don't know how.
In a word, the election, you think, is good news for Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, if you look at his reaction, he certainly thinks so. But I think one caveat I'd put in, Johnny, is that Donald Trump is unpredictable. He is very transactional. We know that in foreign policy. He does have a strong relationship with some of the Gulf Arab leaders who will be pushing hard, especially since October the 7th, and have pushed hard and made a sort of precondition for future deals involving Israel that there is an independent state for the Palestinians. So there will be other pressures on the White House. So, you know, I sort of put a big caveat around everything, you know, I've just told you, basically.
Tom, thank you very much. Stay with us whilst we have a little rootle around the past and try to shed some light on the present. I want to say hello to Dr. Giordana Pulcini, who is in Rome, Associate Professor and Research Fellow at the University of Roma Tre.
Hello.
Thanks so much for joining us. And we're also joined by Dr. Helia, a Senior Associate Fellow in Middle East Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute in London. Hello, HA.
Hello.
We are looking today at this Israeli operation, Operation Opera, Operation Babylon, choose your name, the attack on the Iraqi nuclear reactor called Osirak in June 1981. Giordana, can you just take us briefly through the basics of what happened?
With the raid, Israel bombed the reactor, destroyed the reactor using U.S.-delivered F-16 aircrafts given to Israel by the United States. The reason why Israel decided to destroy the reactor, it was because it thought that it could represent a proliferation risk for the country, that it could be the beginning of an Iraqi weapon nuclear program.
Israel's bombing raid on that Iraqi atomic reactor is getting open praise in only one country this morning, Israel. From the rest of the world, condemnation.
The United States were shocked.
The United States government condemns the reported Israeli airstrike on the Iraq nuclear facility.
H.A., why did they want to destroy a nuclear reactor?
From the Israeli narrative, they considered that what Iraq was doing at the Osirak reactor was, you know, getting close to building a weapon that could eventually be turned on Israel.
Despite all the condemnations which were heaped on Israel for the last 24 hours, Israel has nothing to apologize for. Ours is a just cause.
Now, I do say there's huge historical problems with this narrative. Their claim was that Iraq was building this weapon, and they didn't have the evidence to put out there in order to argue that. And then the second part of the narrative was that they managed to hold back or to, you know, put pause on the development of different types of weapons within Iraq. And actually, there are quite a few historians that argue that as a result of the attack, the Iraqis actually accelerated their attempts, but just did so more on the ground.
Jordana, can I just check in one point with you? Yeah. What were relations like between Israel and Iraq at this point?
So the relation was almost non-existent on official channels. Israel was, in theory, I mean, at least officially, still at war with Iraq. The Iraqi nuclear program was actually not even, I mean, it was really at its beginning, but Israel believed that the Osirak reactor could provide either the enriched uranium that could be shipped by France or the plutonium that could be extracted by the reactor, and that could be used in the future to build a bomb. So Israel felt the pressure to do something to stop the possible development of the nuclear program.
Thank you. Well, over in Washington, D.C., President Reagan is, what, in his fifth month in office. He learns about the attack and he writes in his diary, "I swear I believe Armageddon is near."
We had an emergency cabinet meeting the following morning. Well, then the president went around the table starting at his left, with one single exception. And they were all in favor of strong recriminations. And he got up and stormed out of the room and went into his office.
The U.S. was very critical, H.A., wasn't it, of the attack, along with nearly all of the Western powers and the United Nations Security Council.
Yes, indeed. I actually struggle to remember who expressed any support for the Israelis over the attack at the time. I'm sure there was somebody, but actually it was quite a consensus at the time. Now, just to put the Reagan administration into a little bit of context, prior, of course, to the Reagan administration was the Carter administration. And the Israelis were particularly unenthusiastic about that administration because Carter supported the creation of a Palestinian state. And of course, the Israeli government at the time very opposed to that idea. So when Reagan comes in, though, early on, there were some concerns expressed, not about Reagan himself, but about parts of his administration. But there was an overriding logic around the Reagan administration, which I think also explains what happens later on in the aftermath of the attack, which was he's an anti-communist, obviously. He's a Cold War warrior. This tied very well when it came to the Israelis. So even though there was this massive condemnation, and even though Reagan actually halted, you know, arms sales to Israel for a time, that didn't mean that the relationship collapsed. On the contrary.
Prime Minister Begin, on behalf of the American people, Nancy and I are honored and delighted to welcome you and all those accompanying you. We're proud to stand beside you this morning, joining a tradition of hospitality for Israel observed by our presidents for more than three decades.
there was a very strong development of relations between the Israelis and the United States.
What was the concern for Ronald Reagan about the attack? Was it that it would encourage further conflict in the region, or was it that it would endanger its relationships in the region, or was it something else?
First of all, it might be important to note that the administration was from the start divided in its approach to Israel. So the National Security Council and the Department of State were more supporting of Israel, while the Department of Defense and especially the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, he was more pro-Arab, or at least not as pro-Israel as the Department of State. So this division was there at the moment of the raid, but then, at least at the beginning, there was this condemnation, this clear-cut condemnation. The international concerns were mostly related with, first, the peace negotiations, peace process between Egypt and Israel. And the U.S. government did not want to upset Egypt, Sadat, who decided to move Egypt from the Soviet camp to the U.S. camp. So it was very important not to upset Egypt. And also the other concern was that the United States would be perceived as have been somehow involved in the raid. And the third concern was that the raid could jeopardize the non-proliferation regime, establishing preemptive attack as the way to promote non-proliferation. The domestic concern were related with the, again, possible reaction in the Congress, negative reaction to the fact that Israel was not respecting arms export control agreement with the United States. So Israel received the weapons and arms from the United States, but they could use them only for self-defense, and it was not clear that it was self-defense. And the other concern was that the Congress was very much interested in protecting the non-proliferation regime, and so this is somehow connected with the bigger international issue of non-proliferation.
H.A., Jordana mentions there the restriction that's placed on the transfer and sales of weapons from the US to Israel, that they're only to be used in self-defense. Israel, with this attack on the Osirak reactor, creates a new form of defense in its eyes, this Menachem Begin doctrine of preemptive defense, doesn't it, which it has carried through the decades since then.
And there's two points really to make of that. One, the inevitable conclusion of such a doctrine is, you know, the bizarre kind of thing that we've seen over the past few months, which is de-escalation through escalation, which is, you know, I mean, for anybody that's familiar with military doctrine, it's just absolutely ridiculous. But it's something that's played out quite substantially over the past year. The other is that there are very clear, as Jordana mentioned, very clear restrictions that are placed on these transfers. And built into these restrictions are obviously penalties, right? So red lines being established, and if they're crossed, then penalties or other actions have to take place in ways that, you know, we can't fathom today. Why aren't the red lines being respected? And why aren't we actually putting into effect the consequences?
Tom Bateman in Washington, I mean, you have pretty long experience when you're a Middle East correspondent of Israeli tactics and understandings. That idea of preemptive defense has become baked into the way that Israel looks at the region and looks at the threats around it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's sometimes called rise up and kill first. And we've heard, you know, senior members of the Israeli government to repeat that mantra. I think that particularly when you look back to that era and before the war of 1967, when Israel was particularly viewed by the United States as fighting for its sort of existential future in the region ever since its establishment in 1948, that, as you say, that had been sort of baked into the thinking. And then with the preeminence of Menachem Begin and others, and I think you can see Benjamin Netanyahu is very much in the same sort of ideological thread in Israel, that has been certainly a predominant sort of military doctrine.
Some said that, as we were mentioning before, OSIRIS had been successful in delaying the development of the Iraqi nuclear program, and others said that it was not. It actually, by making it underground, it made it possible. So it was very much discussed, this idea of the effectiveness of preemptive strikes, especially for non-proliferation goals, but the debate has been still to these days inconclusive. So there are this division, these sharp divisions between these two camps.
OSIRIS and the raid on OSIRIS is just one example of a time when Israel and the US have at least temporarily diverged, and the US has been happy to publicly criticise Israel. This relationship does wax and wane, doesn't it? It may have a solid basis underneath, but there are times when the US has been perfectly happy to criticise Israel openly.
So I think that it's more about it being solid than about it being willing to criticize. And generally speaking, it's very clear just in terms of policy that the policy stays pretty consistent. Over the past year, you've seen the Biden administration say critical things about the Israelis on occasion, but the policy doesn't shift. The provision of support at the UN or in terms of arms or in terms of financial assistance, etc., that doesn't shift.
And Jordana, that early US condemnation of the raid on OSIRIS in 1981 would turn gradually until what? Until you saw conservatives and neoconservatives a couple of decades on, even earlier, saying they did the right thing.
Yeah, exactly. That was how the raid was interpreted later on, even by members of the Reagan administration. But even after the raid in 1981 and 1982, the United States gradually changed its position from decondemnation to, we were talking about red lines. Well, there were some red lines that the United States used to protect Israel after the raid when decondemnation inside international organizations like the United Nations, but also the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, became too much. So when it was possible that Israel could be suspended, the United States decided to draw a line and again support Israeli presence in this organization. And also, it is important to remember that the suspension of the delivery of four F-16 aircrafts, which was the measure that was taken by the administration right after the raid, lasted only until August.
And again, Mr. Prime Minister, welcome to America.
Thank you. Mr. President, my colleagues and I are grateful to you and to Mrs. Reagan for your kind invitation.
So it was a short-lived condemnation, and quite quickly the United States went back to protecting Israeli international position.
H.A., we've talked a lot about what the Americans think of Israel through the lens of OSIRIS and how it went down the decades. What about Israel and how much it listens to America? When it comes to its own national interests, what it sees as sort of existential interests, it will do what it wants?
I think it's a bit more complex than that. I think that when Israel made those calculations then, and when it's made those calculations since, including over the past year, a big part of the discussion internally is, what do we think the Americans will actually do if we do this? And by and large, and they've been right about this over the decades, and you know, particularly more recently, their calculation has been they won't do very much, so they can lump it. It's not that they're willing to take some big, massive, huge risk and they go off and they take that big, massive, huge risk. I think that they recognize that actually, after that's said and done, Israel is or was an issue of bipartisan consensus in the United States, and they didn't think that there was that much risk. I do think things are slightly different over the past few years because it's no longer such a bipartisan consensus, at least in the Democratic Party, with the changing demographics of the youth and the progressive wing and so on. But even over the past year, as you've seen, the Israelis have very clearly calculated that they can pretty much do what they want to do and expect little more than rhetoric from an American administration.
We try on this program, sometimes in vain, to draw lines from the event that we're discussing in the past to where we are now. Jordana, do you think there are lines, lessons, even rhymes in history that we can draw from what happened in Osirak?
Okay, so in 1981, the United States, the condemnation of the Osirak raid did not last for long. So, and that was actually what Israel was expecting. And on the other side, the lesson that the United States took away from Osirak was that they could not really afford to like withdraw the support to Israel, especially in the international organization, because they might lose control of what happens there. And this might reinforce Israeli sense that at the end of the day, the United States are going to bake them to a certain point.
My read of Osirak is that it represents one example of a lack of respect for international law and the failure of the multilateral international order to actually hold things up. And there are consequences to that. This doctrine of, you know, preemptive defense, as it were, I think led us eventually to the Iraq war post 9/11. And of course, there's not a direct line in such things in international relations. But I think that when you have a degrading of the rules-based order at any point, it has consequences for later on. And I think about that a lot at the moment, because I think that what you've seen with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Israel's war on Gaza and on Lebanon, we've really seen the degrading of the rules-based order. And I think we all ought to be very concerned about where that will leave us when the next crisis comes about, as inevitably it will.
H.A. Jordana, I just want to say thank you so much for joining us on The Conflict and taking us back to Osirak and drawing the lines out. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Tom in Washington, Tom Bateman, a final word to you. What do you think echoes down the decades from Osirak? What do you recognise in present-day Israel and in the relationship between Israel and the US?
Well, I think there's two things. I think, first of all, is to look at the context of the region, of the Middle East. And I think listening to the story of Osirak and how the Americans under Reagan reacted then has parallels with now. You see an American administration really unhappy with some of the behavior of their very close ally that they're arming. But I think there's a key difference to now. Back then in the early 1980s, you know, you actually saw the Reagan administration pull fighter jets, albeit just for a few months. That is something that I think is utterly unthinkable now. You know, one of the big things you have to remember is back in the early 1980s, you had the context of the Cold War. You had the ability for Arab countries in the Middle East to effectively block the US's energy supply in terms of oil. So the leverage that the Arab countries could apply on Washington was greater then. And the second point, I think, Johnny, is just about when you see these moments of wavering, you know, of tension in the relationship between the US and Israel, it's always still based upon what the Americans see as being in Israel's best interests. Because most of what they were worried about back in the 1980s is the same as today, is that Israel was effectively overreaching. The one big problem with that sort of outside-in approach is it tends to sideline the issue of the Palestinians. And in the long term, you don't get a resolution to what is at the very foundation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Our thanks to Tom Bateman, the BBC State Department correspondent in the US. That's it for The Conflict from The Explanation on the BBC World Service. Wherever you are and however you feel about the conflict, thanks for listening. Until next time.